And so our passage, this last chapter of Genesis, is going to take us through the deaths of two major figures throughout the book of Genesis, Jacob or Israel and his son Joseph. And they're both going to die in Genesis chapter 50. So there's a lot of death in the end of Genesis. It focuses in on death, and that kind of seems to be the theme, as a couple of these major characters throughout the story, it says, breathe their last. And so that means that the book of Genesis is a kind of apparent tragedy. You know, we classify stories as comedy or tragedy, and every story can fit into one of those two things. And a tragedy, they say, is a story that begins with a wedding and ends with a funeral. And then a comedy is the other way around. It begins with a funeral and ends with a wedding. Things get happier and better, and then we laugh at the reversal. But it makes the book of Genesis kind of an apparent tragedy, right? It began with a wedding in a garden in paradise, and now it's ending with a funeral in exile in Egypt. And that's really particular. Like, the last line of Genesis is that Joseph died, he breathed his last, and he was entombed in, he was, what do they call that when they preserve your body like that? Embalmed, and buried in Egypt. So that's how Genesis ends. It moves from a wedding in paradise to a death in exile, away from the promised land, not receiving the things that had been promised. So that's the book of Genesis. And so we're going to look a little bit today at why. I mean, why is Genesis a tragedy? Why end really starkly on this death in exile? Why is this the way it goes? And no doubt, as we think about death in general this morning, death is it's a scary thing, right? Death is an enemy. It's an expression of God's curse on mankind for our sin. And it's a present reality, but it's not the way things were intended to be. So we started in the beginning of Genesis where there was no death and everything was good and there was no sorrow and there was no sin, and therefore there was no death and everything was life and glory and blessing. But then in our rebellion, we cut ourselves off from the source of life, and death has come as a curse. It's come as a response to our sin, so that death comes as an enemy and death spreads to all because all have sinned. And so every one of you, including myself, unless Jesus comes back, is going to die. Like this, none of us escape out of here apart from death. And Jesus himself, when he saw his friend Lazarus die, wept. He was grieved by it. He says, this isn't the way it was meant to be. This isn't the normal order of things. Or the book of Hebrews says that Jesus came to deliver all those who through fear of death were subject to lifelong slavery. So what does that mean? Like, all of us, the Bible says, are afraid of dying. All of us know that death is coming. Romans says that our consciences testify, every one of us, that the sins that we've committed are deserving of death. That we all know deep down somewhere, even if we try to kind of stuff it down, that we deserve to die. And Hebrews tells us that we're all actually afraid to die. And I think a lot of people will admit this, and other people don't in general, and say, well, I'm not afraid to die. I actually was hearing a song on the radio just the other day where the chorus was, I'm not afraid to die, I'm not afraid to die, I'm not afraid to die, I'm not afraid to die. And he said it so many times that I could tell he was just trying to convince himself of that. It's a funny song. He's worried his airplane is going down, so he's writing this song to his mother. He's saying, I'm not afraid to die, I'm not afraid to die. But the Hebrews says that we are afraid to die. And that as because of that, the devil uses that, Hebrews says, to cause us to be subject to lifelong slavery to him through this fear of death. Like, there's no way out. I know I'm headed for condemnation because I've sinned, and my conscience tells me I'm deserving of death and I'm afraid to die. And so I just am going to grab whatever I can in this life and try to get what I can before it's too late. And so he holds us in slavery under that, that fear of death. There's this powerful poem. I mean, this is, like I said, sometimes we deny it, but in general, it's pretty widely understood that death is scary. It's difficult. It's a hard thing to face. There's this poem that was made popular in the movie Inception. So I won't do nearly as good as Michael Caine in that movie, kind of quoting it. But I think it helps to paint the picture of what we as humans feel in the face of death. He says, don't go gentle into that good night. Old age should burn and rave at close of day. Rage, rage against the dying of the light. Though wise men at their end know dark is right, because their words had forked no lightning, they do not go gentle into that good night. Good men the last wave by, crying how bright their frail deeds might have danced in a green bay. Rage, rage against the dying of the light. Wild men who caught and sang the sun in flight and learned too late they grieved it on its way, do not go gentle into that good night. Grave men near death who see with blinding sight, blind eyes could blaze like meteors and be gay. Rage, rage against the dying of the light. We feel like death, there's something wrong with it. Like, we don't just want to face it in peace and calm, but we want to resist it. We don't like it. It doesn't seem the way things were created to be. And another guy named Carl Jung says it less poetically, but I think more directly like this. He says, death is indeed a fearful piece of brutality. There's no sense in pretending otherwise. It's brutal not only as a physical event, but far more so psychically. A human being is torn away from us, and what remains is the icy stillness of death. There no longer exists any hope of a relationship, for all the bridges have been smashed at one blow. And Genesis has shown us this, that death is not natural. It's not the way it was meant to be. And we all kind of know that, and we all kind of feel that, and that's the picture I'm trying to paint for us here, that death is this plague that's spread to all of us because we've all rebelled against God. And so, really, Genesis 50 is a good chapter to be in during Holy Week, right? Because Holy Week is the week of preparation up to the day of Easter, the Resurrection Sunday, when we're celebrating that Jesus came back from the dead. But this week, like the Sunday before Resurrection Day, Jesus was coming into Jerusalem as the king, but he knew that he was coming in to face his death. He had set his face like flint to walk into Jerusalem to go, to be crucified and handed over and betrayed and to be killed. And so as we prepare ourselves for this great celebration of the resurrection, it's helpful for us to remember that the week before the empty tomb was a dark week. It was a week of death. Jesus was preparing for his story to be an apparent tragedy during Holy Week, wasn't he? He was the Messiah. He was the one who had come and would rescue his people and save us from sin and lead them and set his people free. And then the next thing they know, he's being rejected and betrayed and handed over and crucified and put to a public, humiliating, shameful, failure-looking death. And that's what happens. That's Friday. That's he goes to the cross and his life becomes an apparent failure, an apparent tragedy, like the book of Genesis, that what started off so promising has now ended in death, an apparent failure. And yet, there's something glorious about the end of Genesis because there's something glorious about the end of the story of Jesus. And that is, death is not the end of the line. While death is hard and it's scary and it's not right and we rage against it and we know and it's violent and it's this icy cold thing, we know that the reality is that we serve a God who's able to turn a tragedy into a comedy, who's able to take a story whose end is the grave and then spin that out into a new story where the grave actually brings forth new life and dead people spring back from the grave and live forever and are united ultimately in this great wedding feast in the end of all history when the church is united with Jesus, both of them having been resurrected from the dead, and ends with a wedding. And so, while we look at the book of Genesis and we kind of juxtapose that with the life of Jesus, we're going to see what it looks like for a people who face death not afraid. We can see what it looks like for a people trusting in God's promises, a people trusting in Jesus, a people trusting in the God who raises the dead, to be able to face death as this monster, but to be able to face it with faith. And really with a calm kind of repose that we're going to see in both Jacob and Joseph as they approach this. Because we have the God who has defeated death and actually turned it into a doorway into everlasting life. So let's read Genesis 50. We're going to actually start in 49:28 because we need to pick up a little bit at the end of chapter 49. So Genesis 49:28 says, all these are the 12 tribes of Israel. Remember, he's just finished blessing all of his kids. This is what their father said to them as he blessed them, blessing each with the blessing suitable to him. Then he commanded them and said to them, I am to be gathered to my people. Bury me with my fathers in the cave that is in the field of Ephron the Hittite. Excuse me. Allergy season. In the cave that is in the field at Machpelah to the east of Mamre in the land of Canaan, which Abraham bought with the field from Ephron the Hittite to possess as a burying place. There they buried Abraham and Sarah his wife. There they buried Isaac and Rebekah his wife. And there I buried Leah. The field and the cave that is in it were bought from the Hittites. When Jacob finished commanding his sons, he drew up his feet into the bed and breathed his last and was gathered to his people. Then Joseph fell on his father's face and wept over him and kissed him. And Joseph commanded his servants, the physicians, to embalm his father. So the physicians embalmed Israel. 40 days were required for it, for that is how many are required for embalming. And the Egyptians wept for him 70 days. And when the days of weeping for him were past, Joseph spoke to the household of Pharaoh, saying, "If now I have found favor in your eyes, please speak in the ears of Pharaoh, saying, 'My father made me swear, saying, I'm about to die. In my tomb that I hewed out for myself in the land of Canaan, there shall you bury me. Now, therefore, let me please go up and bury my father, and then I will return.' And Pharaoh answered, 'Go up and bury your father, as he made you swear.' So Joseph went up to bury his father. With him went up all the servants of Pharaoh, the elders of his household, and all the elders of the land of Egypt, as well as all the household of Joseph, his brothers, and his father's household. Only their children, their flocks, and their herds were left in the land of Goshen. And there went up with him both chariots and horsemen. It was a very great company. When they came to the threshing floor of Atad, which is beyond the Jordan, they lamented there with a very great and grievous lamentation, and he made a mourning for his father 7 days. When the inhabitants of the land, the Canaanites, saw the mourning on the threshing floor of Atad, they said, 'This is a grievous mourning by the Egyptians.' Therefore the place was named Abel Mizraim. It is beyond the Jordan." Thus his sons did for him as he had commanded them. For his sons carried him to the land of Canaan and buried him in the cave of the field at Machpelah to the east of Mamre, which Abraham bought with the field from Ephron the Hittite to possess as a burying place. After he'd buried his father, Joseph returned to Egypt with his brothers and all who had gone up with him to bury his father. When Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, "It may be that Joseph will hate us and pay us back for all the evil that we did to him." So they sent a message to Joseph, saying, "Your father gave this command before he died. Say to Joseph, 'Please forgive the transgression of your brothers and their sin, because they did evil to you. And now, please forgive the transgression of the servants of the God of your father.' Joseph wept when they spoke to him. His brothers also came down and fell down before him and said, 'Behold, we are your servants.' But Joseph said to them, 'Do not fear, for am I in the place of God? As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, to bring it about that many people should be kept alive as they are today. So do not fear. I will provide for you and your little ones.' Thus he comforted them, and he spoke kindly to them. So Joseph remained in Egypt, he and his father's house. Joseph lived 110 years, and Joseph saw Ephraim's children of the third generation. The children also of Machir, the son of Manasseh, were counted as Joseph's own. And Joseph said to his brothers, 'I am about to die, but God will visit you and bring you up out of this land to the land that he swore to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob.' Then Joseph made the sons of Israel swear, saying, 'God will surely visit you, and you shall carry up my bones from here.' So Joseph died, being 110 years old. They embalmed him, and he was put in a coffin in Egypt." And that's the end of the book of Genesis. So why this focus on death? Why zero in on everybody dying at the end? Like, why not just stop with the blessings? Chapter 49, he takes his sons and he gives these prophetic blessings, and some are going to be kind of disciplined and hard, but in general it's positive, and the blessing is spreading and God's work is happening. But now we kind of wrap up Genesis and everybody's dying. Why zero in on this? And it's so that we can see what it looks like to approach death in faith. So let's look at this. First Jacob and then Joseph. First Jacob dies in faith. And when Jacob dies, he dies as a man expecting that God's going to keep his promises. So this is how he approaches this difficult, scary thing, this moment of death where he's going to pass into something he's never seen before. He doesn't know. He knows it's hard. And he does this expecting that God is going to keep his promises. He does so expecting that he's going to continue existing after death, that he's going to make it through, and that he's going to get his body back one day. So look at this. First, he approaches death confident in God's promise to bless the world through his offspring. So he gets ready to die by passing on the blessing of God to his offspring. That's what we saw earlier in chapter 49. He knows that God's promise is going to happen even though he's not seeing any of it. Remember, we saw this in Genesis 49, that it was surprising for a guy who's in exile, who hasn't received any of God's promises himself, now passing them on and gathering his children around to pass them on to them, because he hasn't even seen them himself. So he's approaching death in faith, knowing that God's promises are going to come true even if he doesn't get to see it in his lifetime. He also approaches death confident in life after death and in the resurrection. Look at this. First, he's confident of life after death. Look at verse 29. He commanded them and said to them, I am to be gathered to my people. Bury me with my fathers in the cave that is in the field of Ephron, the Hittite. And also in verse 33, it says, when Jacob finished commanding his sons, he drew up his feet into the bed and breathed his last and was gathered to his people. So that means that this isn't the end. He's dying, his heart's stopping beating, but he's going somewhere else. He's going to be with his people, and he knows that. He's telling them, this is what's going to happen. I'm about to be gathered to go with my people. So he's facing death with a confidence that this isn't just the end of existence. He's not just going to stop being. He's not just going to go back to dirt and then be fertilizer for somebody else. He's confident that who he is going to live on. And he's also confident in the resurrection, because that's a little different from the resurrection, isn't it? He's going to live on, and his spirit is going to go, his body's going to die, and his spirit's going to be gathered to be with his ancestors. But as Christians, we uniquely have a hope that not only is our spirit going to live on, but that our body is going to be raised back up from the dead and transformed into this new glorious body that we're going to live with forever. That's the hope of the resurrection. So he knows that he's going to live on after death, but he also knows that he's going to get his body back. And I say that because why else would he make such careful preparations for what's going to happen to his body? That's what the whole rest of chapter 49 is about, right? He's like, I'm about to be gathered to my people. Take me with my fathers in the field that's in the field of Ephron, the tomb that's in the field of Ephron, the Hittite. Bring me back to Canaan. He wants to be in the land of Canaan after he dies. He wants his bones and his body to rest there. Why? Why does he care? He's dying. He's leaving. Isn't he just leaving the body behind? And isn't it just a shell that he's cast away? And who cares what happens to it? Who cares if it's in Egypt? Who cares if it's in Canaan? Well, he cares. Why does he care? Because he believes that there's a future for his body. He believes God's not done with his body yet, that God is going to raise him from the dead and he's going to fulfill his promises. Because God made promises to him that he was going to inherit that land, and he never inherited it. So what do we conclude from that? Either that God doesn't keep his promises, or that God is the God who raises the dead in order to keep his promises. And that's what Jacob believes. So he makes preparation for his body to be laid in the cave with Abraham and Sarah and Isaac and Rebekah. And then his own wife, Leah, is laying there waiting for him. So resurrection is this uniquely Christian, beautifully glorious truth that we're getting our bodies back, that the physical creation is not an accident, it's not just something to be overcome, it's something that God actually did and likes and said, this is good and it's very good, and when the body dies, that's not good, and so he's made a plan that we're going to get new bodies back, that we're going to heaven now and we're going to be with, our spirit will be with Jesus until the day of resurrection when we will be brought back to a new heavens and a new earth. And that's where we will live with new bodies that are these bodies risen back up into something far more glorious. And that's what he believes. This is a unique thing that we believe and that we know to be true, and it's going to happen. Only Jesus offers this kind of genuine, substantial hope in the face of death. Other spiritual leaders may promise a kind of vague existence after death, but none of them have demonstrated this like Jesus has in coming and actually raising back from the dead himself and showing that he is the Lord of death, that he has defeated it. So Jacob dies knowing that his existence is going to continue. He also dies making preparations for his body to be risen back, that he's going to be reunited with a glorious body in the day of the resurrection. And then he dies. So this is the end of chapter 49, verse 33. When he finished commanding his sons, he drew up his feet into the bed, he breathed his last, and he was gathered to his people. Look at the intentionality of this guy's death. I mean, there's no flailing. There's no clawing. There's purposefulness here, isn't there? There's just commanding the sons, this is what I want you to do with my body. This is what's going to happen. Takes his feet, puts them in the bed, lays down, breathes out his last, and is gathered to his people. And what a glorious way to go. Look how purposefully God allows him to go. This calm purposefulness in the face of this dark enemy that's death. Because as we talked about, it is a scary thing to face death. We maybe don't like to think about it. We put it out of our minds. We maybe think we don't spend too much time pondering what that moment is going to be like when we step into a threshold of something we've never experienced before. And we have no idea what that's going to look like in the details. And he approaches this and he faces it with this great faith in the promises and the provision of God. He doesn't need to rage against the dying of the light. He's not clinging on. He's ready to go. Now, to me, it sounds like he doesn't go alone. I don't want to make too much of this, but it says he breathed out his last and he was gathered to his people. That sounds to me like angels maybe were there to transition him from one place to another. Because sometimes I wonder, maybe this seems morbid to you, but I wonder, like, what's it going to be like after I die? Like 2 seconds after my heart stops beating and I've taken my last breath, what's existence going to be like? Is it going to take time to get there to the presence of Jesus? Or are we just going to be like instantly transported? What kind of sensations will I have? Because I won't have my body, so will I feel excitement without a body and the chemicals that produce the kind of sensations we now know? What's it going to be like? Will I see other people immediately? Where will I go first? What's it going to look like? Will I be able to see? Because I won't have eyes, but surely I'll be experiencing it. Something's going to be happening there. But you also kind of wonder, like, am I going to be totally alone? Because I'm going to step across there, and as many people as kind of are always around us, we step across that boundary by ourselves. And I think that can be a little bit scary too. But I like here that it says he's gathered to his people. I mean, it sounds to me like, and again, I don't want to push it too far, but there are spirit beings like there ready to kind of bring him to where he's going. So this is how Jacob's death looks, and after he dies, now his people weep. Because one day every tear is going to be wiped away. But what Jung called the icy stillness of death still feels a bit icy to us, doesn't it, who are left behind. The one who passes over, it's Paul says, it's far better, because they're in the presence of glory. But for the ones left behind, it's hard. And so Joseph falls on him, and he weeps, and he kisses him. Then he has him embalmed, and then the Egyptians weep for him for 70 days. That's a long grieving period. And the Egyptians are doing that. Why are the Egyptians weeping over him? He was a great man, I take it. And they came to love him while he was living there among them. So they weep 70 days. Joseph falls on him, weeps. The Egyptians themselves weep 70 days. Then Joseph obeys his father's wishes. He prepares his body, and he's bringing it to Canaan, where his dad wants to be buried in his cave with his people. So Joseph, he's obeying his father's wishes. He's taking his body to go to be in Canaan. And all of Pharaoh's servants and all of Pharaoh's elders go with Joseph and his brothers. That's also really interesting. I mean, not only are the Egyptians weeping for 70 days, but they're like sending all of their people on this procession to take him to his burial place. Like all the great people of Egypt are all there, and all of Israel, and they're all, see what honor they're giving to Jacob, who's been used by God to bless Egypt. When they cross the Jordan to go into Canaan, they stop and they weep again for another week. It says with a very great and grievous lamentation. Death is hard, especially for those who are left behind. I mean, for the one who gets to go, there's glory and there's relief and there's greatness. But for those who are left behind, there's lots of weeping. And as they get him back into Canaan, why do they weep? It's because they crossed the Jordan, and now this is the land. This is the land that Dad, this is the land that Grandpa spent his entire life saying, God promised us, this is our land. He's going to give this to us. He's going to restore the world to paradise here in this land, but he never got to see it. As you can see, you can imagine the emotion of that process of bringing his body across the Jordan into the land of Canaan. And like, this was Dad's hope. Like, this land was what he set his heart on and where he set his hope. But he never got to see it. Like, there's some sorrow there. But we know that in the resurrection, he will see it, right? That's why they're bringing his body there. He's going to rise, and that's what he's going to see first. So they're weeping, they cross the Jordan, they're weeping, and they bring his body there, and they deposit it, and they put it in the cave, and you can actually still go to that cave today and find Abraham's bones, and Isaac's bones, and Jacob's bones, and their wives' bones, and monks throughout the ages have gone in there and like washed the bones with wine and preserved them and kind of stacked them around. And right now it's kind of held by people who are a little bit hostile to the Christian faith, and so they don't really like people going in there, and so they kind of guard it, but it's a real place. You could go there and see where they put his bones, like so long ago. But while Jacob's dying, there's one more thing I want us to see about his faith in the midst of death, in the face of death, and that's that as he's dying, he's thinking about the good of others. He's thinking about the good of his children. I think this is really striking, because when I even just get kind of sick, I start really thinking about myself, you know, like, well, I'm going to need lots of babying, lots of attention because I'm not feeling well, right? So all of a sudden I turn like quite selfish and I have to really resist that, to not think like it's all about me when I'm sick. But here is a guy, he's dying, like he's coming to the end of his life. And if there's ever a time where you need to say like, okay, I need a little bit of attention on me now, you know, like I've been doing these things and everything and giving out the blessings and all this, but like I'm about to die. So why don't you guys kind of gather around and here's what I need you to do for me. Right? I'm about to pass over to the other side, and it's scary, and it's hard, and it's crazy, and it's weird, and it's difficult. But that's not what he's doing. Instead, he's thinking about his children, and he's thinking about their reconciliation with one another. And what a beautiful thing. It's kind of like the true Israel, who when he was facing death, hanging on the cross, rather than thinking about how dare they do this to me or me, and what do I need? Instead, he's hanging on the cross, dying, saying, Father, forgive these people who are crucifying me, for they know not what they do. Look at what faith in Christ does to a person, even in the midst of the hardest things, even in the face of death. So he dies exalting forgiveness and grace among his sons. Now we're in chapter 50, around verse 15. When Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, it may be that Joseph will hate us and pay us back for all the evil we did to him. Remember, they sold him into slavery and all that. So they're worried. Now that dad's dead, maybe he's going to get his vengeance. So they sent a message to Joseph saying, your father gave this command before he died. Say to Joseph, please forgive the transgression of your brothers and their sin because they did evil to you. And now, please forgive the transgression of the servants of the God of your father. Joseph wept when they spoke to him. So Jacob's dead, but we get this message kind of from beyond the grave, right? He's already dead. He's been buried. They come back. And now there's this message, and the brothers come, and they're like, look, dad said it's really important that you forgive us, even though we did this evil against you. Please forgive us. And so this is Jacob making provision, right, even as he's getting ready to die. We get this kind of glimpse back into his final preparations. He's told Joseph's brothers that he needs to forgive them. It's like, make sure that Joseph knows this was what I wanted, that he forgives you as brothers. Please forgive, he says. So he dies commending and commanding grace and forgiveness, right? This is what it's about. I want you to forgive one another. I want you to forgive your brothers. I want you to show grace to them. I think there's probably something here about the perspective that death brings, you know, as you're getting ready to go and meet God. You're realizing probably really, really with crystal clarity, like I'm a person who lives by mercy alone. Forgiveness is probably becoming very, very crystal clear. Like this is the one thing that's really, really needful is grace and forgiveness, because I'm about to go and stand before my judge and I'm going to give an account for every word that I've spoken and everything that I've done. I would think that would really bring grace into clear focus. You know, it's like they say with astronauts, they call it the overview effect. When an astronaut goes out and they turn around and they look back and they can see Earth for the first time as a whole from an outside perspective, they have this like really profound experience. They call it the overview effect. And it just, they say, all of a sudden, all the squabbles and the struggles and the problems, the interpersonal things and even national struggles on Earth just seem like really, really petty. And there's, it just gives them this like great perspective. Like, wow, from here, what does it matter so much? You know, that crossword that so-and-so said to me, or this or that squabble, or even this war that we're having. Like, what really does it matter in the grand scheme? And it has this profound effect. And I'm thinking, it's a similar thing that death is having this effect on, on Jacob. He's getting a lot of perspective, and grace is for on the forefront of his mind. So that's Jacob, that's Israel dying in faith. Okay, he's hoping, he knows he's going to live on. He's making preparations to receive his body back. He's making preparations for grace to rule among his sons, for things to be left well. And now we're going to see Joseph forgive. Joseph's going to follow that advice. And then we're going to take just a few minutes to see how Joseph dies. And it's very similar. But first, we want to see Joseph forgive. Joseph takes the advice. And I want you to notice a few things. So they said, as they came and they fall before him and they say, "We're your servants. Dad said you have to forgive us. Make sure you do." Verse 19, "But Joseph said to them, 'Do not fear, for am I in the place of God?'" So Joseph forgives, but I want you to notice how he forgives. There are two reasons that Joseph can forgive this like great evil that his brothers have carried out on him. Like a great, great evil. They faked his death and sold him into slavery, and he was gone for years and years and years and years. And then they lied about it to cover it up. Like, this is really, really evil. But notice how he can forgive. Joseph said to them, "Do not fear. Why? For am I in the place of God?" So what's he saying first? Like, God's the one who makes things right. God is the one who will take vengeance. "Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord. I will repay." So because he knows that, because he knows that God will make everything right, he's free to not have to try to make everything right himself. And so he's free by that truth to just forgive. He can settle in it. And he can say, if God chooses to show them mercy, God will show them mercy and he will make it right. If God chooses to judge them for what they've done, God will judge them and he will make it right. But it's not mine to do. And so he's just able to freely forgive. So you see how being grounded in the truth that God will make everything right, the more we believe that, the more we can let go of when we've been wronged by others. We don't have to try to inflict vengeance. We don't have to try to make it right ourselves. And the second reason he can forgive them, first, he says to them, "Don't fear, for am I in the place of God," right? Am I going to take vengeance on you? And secondly, "As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, to bring it about that many people should be kept alive as they are today. So do not fear. I will provide for you and your little ones." So the second reason that Joseph can forgive is because he knows the sovereignty of God. He can forgive because he can say, "Look, I know that you guys intended evil for me through this act, this really evil thing that you did, but God actually was working out his good purposes through it. And so I don't have to be bitter. I don't have to be angry. I don't have to be bitter because I know that God uses even the evil, sinful, wicked acts of men to bring about his good purposes." Isn't that what he says? "As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, to bring it about that many people should be kept alive as they are today." He can rest in the confidence that God uses even the worst of human sin to carry out his good purposes. And so he can just rest in that. It's okay. Yeah, I can forgive you. God was working this out the whole time, and look at what he's done through it. People may mean all sorts of evil against God's children, but God uses even those evil-intentioned acts to bring about his saving purposes. That's true. That's true for you. And if that's true for you, then like, what can touch you? Right? What suffering can't we see in the final analysis to have been God working out his good purposes for you? Isn't that great? I mean, we can let things go because we can say, my God is able even to use this suffering that I'm facing right now, this hardship, this difficulty, whatever's weighs on you that you think I can't get out from under that. Is God able to use that for your good and for the good of his purposes and his kingdom? He is. Slavery, oppression, injustice, prison, years of mistreatment, all being used by God for good, for Joseph. You see how practical good theology is? You see how those like doctrines, like God is the one who repays, God is sovereign over all things, he takes those two truths and he's set free by them to just be a forgiving, gracious person in the face of evil. So he forgives his brothers. He treats them with grace. It says he provides for them, he comforts them, and he speaks kindly to them. And now we come to the last section of the book, and that's Joseph's time to die. So we fast forward, because the theme here is death. Right? We don't get the rest of Joseph's life. We're going to fast forward to the end, because we want to talk about his death, because that's the point of Genesis chapter 50, is they're all dying. Joseph gets to see God's blessing of his people. That's verse 22. He lives to be 110 years old, and he gets to see his great-great-grandchildren. So that's good. He's getting to see some of God's blessing, and God's building the people like he's promised. Some of the promises are coming to pass. But then Joseph dies. And when Joseph dies, we're going to see two things. He's focused on God's promise of redemption and on the faith of his people. So look at verse 24. Joseph said to his brothers, "I'm about to die, but God will visit you and bring you up out of this land to the land that he swore to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob." So when Joseph is getting ready to die, he's facing this dark, scary thing that we keep talking about. What's he thinking about? What's pervasive in his thoughts? Is it regret? If only I had done this. If only I had done that. If only less time in the office, right? Is it regret? Is it fear? What's it going to be like? Am I going to make it? Is this going to be the end? Or is there judgment? None of these things are what's occupying his mind. What's occupying his mind are the promises of God. And he's just, this is it. This is the focus. This is what he's lived by, and this is what he's dying by. This is what God has promised. And so he tells them, "I'm about to die, but God's going to visit you, and he's going to bring you out of this land, the land of Egypt, where they're exiled from the promised land, and he's going to bring you to the land that he swore to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob." So he's passing on God's promise. This is what's got his mind captured. So let me read you that promise all the way back from Abraham in Genesis 15. In verse 12, God's making this covenant with Abraham. Remember, the torch passes through. He splits the animals to make this covenant, and the torch passes through. As this is about to happen, Genesis 15:12 says, "As the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell on Abram, and behold, dreadful and great darkness fell upon him. Then the Lord said to Abram, 'Know for certain that your offspring will be sojourners in a land that's not theirs, and will be servants there, and they will be afflicted for 400 years, but I will bring judgment on the nation that they serve, and afterward they shall come out with great possessions. As for you, you should go to your fathers in peace. You should be buried in a good old age.'" So what's God talking about? The Exodus. You're going to go, you're going to end up in Egypt, you're going to be slaves there for 400 years, then God's going to come and he's going to rescue you out with his might and with his power. This is what's on Joseph's mind as he's preparing for his death. He's like, "I'm going to die, but don't forget, God's going to come and he's going to rescue you." These are God's promises. He is the God who saves. So he reminds them of the coming Exodus, keeping God's promises right in front of them, hoping in God's deliverance even when he's not going to see it from earth. So Joseph dies with God's promises in the forefront of his mind, and he dies confident that God will fulfill his promises and that he's going to get his body back. Okay, and this is the last few verses of the chapter. "Then Joseph made the sons of Israel swear, saying, 'God will surely visit you, and you shall carry up my bones from here.' So Joseph died, being 110 years old. They embalmed him, and he was put in a coffin in Egypt." He makes them, again, like Jacob has done, he makes them swear, "Look, God's coming. He's going to rescue you out of here. He's going to bring you back to Canaan, and you better bring my bones with you." Who cares, right? Again, why does he care? Why does he need his bones to go up out of Egypt with them? He's going to be long dead when all of this happens. Because Joseph doesn't think his body is done with. He doesn't think that his body is insignificant. He has hope in the resurrection of the body. He wants his body in Canaan with his people because he knows that God has a future for him. Because if God promised him, "I'm going to give you this place," then you better make sure that it's absolute that God is going to do it. So bring my bones, because God swore it and it's going to happen. And this is what's on his mind as he's dying, like his father, knowing it's not the end and that God is the God of resurrection hope. So this is how Genesis ends. It ends with death, but there's a hint, isn't there, beyond the death. I mean, as they're dying, from the earthly standpoint, Genesis is a tragedy. Starts with a paradise wedding, ends with a funeral in exile. But the thing that gives us hope, the story points beyond itself, doesn't it? Because they're making preparations for their bones. They know something else is coming. And so we see that death is this scary thing that we all face. We see that it's bigger than any of us can deal with, that even if we try not to think about it, that it's there and it's coming and we're all going to face this one day. But we see in the midst of that, that since the children share in flesh and blood, Jesus himself likewise partook of the same things, that through death he might destroy the one who has the power of death, that is the devil, and deliver all those who through fear of death were subject to lifelong slavery. When Jesus faced death, he faced a monster. And when Jesus faced that monster, he was in a garden, and he was in agony, and he was crying out to the Father, and he said, "My soul is sorrowful, even unto death." Think about what that means. My soul is sorrowful, even unto death. He was so consumed with anguish that he thought that it was going to kill him. His soul was so consumed with the sorrow of what was about to come to face death and face the wrath of God that he thought he was going to die just from the sorrow itself. And he's in the garden. He's pleading in agony. All of his friends have deserted him. He's asked them to pray with him. They won't, and they're falling asleep in his hour of need. He's down on the ground. He's crying out. He's sweating like drops of blood as he's getting ready to face death, the monster. And he goes to the cross. He's resolute. He asks, "If there's any other way, let this cup pass from me. If they could just like do some meditation and make it to heaven, just let them do it that way. Let this cup pass from me. If there's any other way, the four noble truths or the way of Islam or the whatever it is, if there's any other way for them to be saved, like let this cup pass from me." And the Father just sends him to the cross. Because there's no other way, because somebody has to go. It has to be the Son of God, and he's got to take on death, and he's the only one who can defeat it. And so he goes, he takes up the cross, he makes the long walk up the hill, he's nailed onto it as a public failure, he's mocked, he's flogged, he's ridiculed, he's called a loser and a failure, and he faces death. And in the face of death, he cries out, my God, why have you forsaken me?" The Father turns his face away, the Father turns towards him in wrath, because he's placed your sin on his back, and then he crushes his Son on the cross. And he seems to be swallowed up by the monster. And then it's just silent for 3 days. And then on the third day, we find that he breaks his way out from inside the monster that's death, and he comes back having defeated it, and he's back to life, and he has triumphed. And so now, when you face death, because every one of us will, we don't face the monster, because the monster's dead, because you can walk straight into its mouth, and you can walk straight out the other side where Jesus made a way, through death, out the other side in resurrection, so that we live with him forever. And so Jesus says that for those who trust in him, you will not taste death. It won't be a monster for you anymore. Because the power is gone. The beast is slain. It's over. It's finished on the cross. And when he rises from the dead, he wins. And so now, we like Jacob and we like Joseph can walk up to the face of this monster, and we can do it with confidence and faith of the promise of God that we will live forever with him. Amen? Amen. Christ has died, taking care of our sin. Christ has risen, taking care of death. And Christ will come again to bring our bodies into everlasting joy. Let's praise him. God, we're so grateful that you have faced death for us. God, it was too big for us. We tremble in the face of it. We rage against the dying of the light. We tremble in fear at the face of the unknown, and knowing that it's dark and it's scary, and it really is. But Lord Jesus, we praise you that you have faced it for us. And so God, I pray that you would give us deep, deep confidence in your promises. God, I pray that we would live by your promises like we see Jacob doing and like we see Joseph doing. That we would live by grace, that we would live by the forgiveness that you've extended to us, and that we would walk in that pattern. And that, Father, we would walk in confidence in your promises, so that even as we approach death, we do so in a way that's astounding to those around us, that we can walk right up to the face of it without fear, because Jesus is our conqueror, and he has already won. We ask it in his great name. Amen.